Let's go back to page 67. Let's go down to the middle of the page.
Yeah.
And it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Uh-oh. Now, we've never done this before. We've always looked to see what those suckers have done to us. Never have we looked to see what we really did to them. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and were willing to set these matters straight. So now then, let's unfold the last two columns on your inventory sheet. If you'll notice, column 4 is headed up with the wording, "What did I do?" Putting out of mind the wrongs others have done, I resolutely look for my own mistakes. What did I do, if anything, to set in motion trains of circumstances which in turn caused people or institutions to hurt me and eventually led to my resentment of them for doing so? So I went to column 4. And I looked at that name, Barbara, on that sheet in column 1. I said, "Okay, Charlie, now you forget what Barbara did to you. You forget those 3 divorces. What did you do, if anything, to set this thing in motion?" And it took me just about 5 seconds to say, well, if I hadn't been out there screwing around — Joe calls it committing adultery, I call it screwing around.
I don't talk that way.
If I hadn't been out there screwing around, I wouldn't have got caught. And if I hadn't have got caught, she probably wouldn't have filed for divorce in the first place. It took me about another 5 seconds to say, if I hadn't have been sneaking around behind her back, lying to her all the time, she probably wouldn't have filed for divorce in the first place. Just another few seconds, and I said, if I hadn't have been blowing all of our money on what I thought was so important, disregarding the welfare of my wife and children, she probably wouldn't have filed for divorce in the first place. And I thought, my God, Charlie, have you got any other resentments like this? Have you conned yourself into believing that it's their fault in order to not have to look at yourself? And I suddenly realized why I loved my resentment so well. Because you see, every time I played a resentment over, I distorted the picture just a little bit. I made what they did just a little bit worse, and I made what I did just a little bit less. And you let me play it long enough, I can convince myself that I had nothing to do with it, and it was all their damn fault in the first place. If you're a practicing alcoholic, you've got to develop these kind of skills. I don't think you and I could live with ourselves, and we're out there doing our thing, if we have to honestly see what's going on in our lives. But you see, we don't ever have to see that, because we've got this convenient little thing called resentments. Play them over and over, distort the picture every time, eventually transfer all blame to them, and make ourselves as pure as the driven snow. And then we can go right on living the kind of life we're wanting to live. And we men go from woman to woman to woman, and you ladies go from man to man to man, and we go from job to job to job, and we go from city to city to city, and we go from state to state to state, And we go from country to country, and it's always their damn fault. I don't think we could live with ourselves if we didn't have that ability. So I said, Charlie, have you got any more on here like this? I looked at the Internal Revenue Service. I said, forget the fact that they're trying to put you in jail. What did you do to set this thing in motion, if anything? And I said, well, that's very simple. I'm cheating on my income tax, and they caught me. Yeah. Joe, what did you do, if anything, to set in motion this deal with you and Rome?
Well, I was out there doing adultery, Charlie. I wasn't screwing around.
Okay.
Spending money I didn't have, trying to impress people I didn't like. But primarily, I got drunk one time when I woke up and I was married. And I didn't intend to do that, but I did. And that's why I would leave and not come home. And I didn't care. Uncaring person. I just didn't care. Finally, I confronted her with that one night, and she said, well, Joe, you're the one who insisted on us getting married. Well, it turned out it was my fault. See? But I didn't know that. But that's the kind of person I was. She's really a great gal. She's a fine person. She really is. As I was just drunk and sick, couldn't do anything better. I always left and came back. Because, see, I didn't know how to come back. I didn't know how to stay gone. I mean, I just didn't know how to stay gone. I'd come back. Now, there's a whole other story behind that, which I don't have time to tell you, but that's what I did. I would leave and stay gone, but I'd come back.
Joe, what did you do, if anything, to set in this motion, this deal with you and your mother-in-law?
I didn't do nothing to her. That's the way it looked. I realized that I hadn't done nothing. It didn't take very long to look and say, what did you do to her? And I realized I had never really done anything to her specifically. But what I had done to her daughter and her grandkids threatened her in the worst way. That was the closest thing in her life. And she retaliated to protect them like any decent person should have done. And I resented her. I resented her because I could not admit to what I was doing. I was not going to take any blame for that, and I used my mother-in-law as a scapegoat. But once I put it down the inventory and saw that it all started with me, you know, that I was the root of the problem, then I didn't need to hold my mother-in-law hostage no more. I didn't need an excuse. I saw my part in the whole thing. I really didn't think I'd know I was using her to escape and end up trapping myself. Like sleeping dirt under the rug.
As I went down through my list of resentments, carefully checking each one to see what I had done to set that in motion, I never found a resentment, period, that I myself hadn't done something to set it in motion. And they had retaliated against me, and I had resented them for doing so. I never had a policeman put me in jail for sober driving. I never had a woman drag me through a divorce court for being a good husband and a good father. I never had anybody beat the hell out of me for keeping my mouth shut. Always, I started it, and I simply did not know that. And I don't think any of us will ever realize that nearly all the resentments we have sometime in the past made a decision based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And it's really not their fault. It's our fault to begin with. Absolutely, completely amazing information when we fill out column 4. Now then we look at column 5. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, or inconsiderate? Which of the above character defects caused me to do what I did, or caused me to want to hold on to the old resentment, even though I may have done nothing to cause it? I went back to Barbara's name. I went back to see the things that I had done to create the problems. And I said to myself, Charlie, were you selfish?
Yeah.
You better bet I was. I wasn't concerned with anybody but me. Selfish and self-centered to the extreme. I said, Charlie, were you dishonest?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sneaking around behind her back, lying to her all the time. Not only her, but everybody else that I was acquainted with, period. I said, were you self-seeking and frightened? I said, oh, yeah. Man, I'm getting close to 40 years old. And I made up my mind that if I don't get out there and get some of that stuff now, it'll soon be too late for me to do so. Fear drives us to do things that end up hurting other people in many, many cases. I said, Charlie, were you inconsiderate? And I said, you better bet I was. If I'd been considering my wife and my children and put their needs and wants ahead of my own, I wouldn't have been doing that kind of stuff in the first place. And for the first time, I began to see the kind of character I had become, the kind of personality that I had developed through my years of living, practicing alcoholism, and running my life on self-will. I began to see where I had become a very selfish human being, a very dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate human being. I always thought I was a pretty good guy. I just drank a little too much. But when I really began to look into that fifth column and began to see the type of character I had become, it made me sick to see that I'm the cause of all these things. And all my actions stem from that kind of personality. And for the first time, I began to realize if I don't do something about that, I'm going to keep right on doing the same old things over and over and over and over and over. If I stay selfish, if I stay dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, I'm going to keep right on hurting people and institutions. They're going to retaliate. I'm going to resent, and eventually I'm going to get drunk over it. But just think, if I could become a little less selfish, don't have to get perfect, I never will, but if I could become a little less selfish, maybe I wouldn't be hurting so many people. If I could become a little less dishonest, maybe I wouldn't be lying and cheating and stealing and being scared to death what they're going to do whenever they catch me. If I could become a little less self-seeking and frightened, then I wouldn't have to do some of those things that hurt other people. If I could become a little less inconsiderate and starting putting other people's needs and wants and desires ahead of my own, just maybe I could start getting along with people. But you can bet your boots if I don't. If I stay selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, then I don't stand a chance. Because I'll do the same old things I've always done. Keep right on hurting people and institutions. And eventually I'm going to get drunk over it. Now just think what we've really accomplished here as we filled out these five columns on this sheet. We're doing step four. This is the resentment part of the inventory. So we put a little four up there at the top of the page. Out there in that fifth column, I now see the exact nature of the wrong that I'm going to talk to another human being about when I take step five. The wrong is the resentment. That's what blocks me off from God. But what is the exact nature of it? What's at the core of it? What's the inherent characteristic of it? And it's always based upon my selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, frightened, or inconsiderate. So that's what we're going to talk about in step five. You know, when a guy comes to me with his step four to take step five, I don't care how many times he's stolen. I don't care whether he's stolen twice or 200. What I'm interested in is what's within him that causes him to do this in the first place. Is he selfish? Is he dishonest? What part of his character causes this? That's what we're going to have to work on. I don't care how many times he's committed adultery, whether he's done it once or 1,000 times. What I'm concerned with is what's within him that causes that. That's what we got to work on. That's the exact nature of the wrong. This is not a list of dirty, filthy, nasty items. Sure, we're going to talk about those things. But that's not what we're concentrating on. We're concentrating on what's within our personality that causes these things. Out there in that fifth column, I now see the character defects that I'm going to become willing to turn loose of in step six. Knowing full well that if I'm not willing to turn loose of them, I'll never change. And if I never change, I'll never get any better. Out there in that fifth column, I now see the shortcomings I'm going to ask God to take away in step seven. And hopefully, with God's help and all the strength I can muster, we begin to change some of those things. And my personality begins to undergo a change too. Over there in the first column, in my case, every name in the first column, in your case, some of them, but in my case, every one of them is somebody, an institution, or a person that I've harmed. And they're going to come off of this list and be added to a sheet to be used later on for steps 8 and 9. The book says when we get to 8 and 9, we've got the list, we made it when we took step 4. And part of the list comes off of this resentment sheet. So if I've done this step 4 resentment-wise the way the big book says, I now have all the information I need for steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 resentment-wise. And let me ask you something. Did we do anything to be afraid of? Did we do anything that was too complicated? A very simple procedure.
Did we write down anything of dirty, filthy, nasty things? No. An immoral inventory? No. We simply did what the book said. We saw the facts, we faced the facts, and we're going to enter into a process so we can accept the facts. That's all.
Now, one more thing, and then we're through. And sometimes I upset people when I say this, but that's okay. I don't mind. I've been sober long enough, it really doesn't bother me that much anymore. If you've got a resentment that you don't want to get rid of, knowing full well now that it might get you drunk, and you don't want to get rid of it, for God's sake, let's put it down on this sheet of paper. And let's look at the truth behind it. You know, I hear some of you saying, and I hear awful good.
Charlie does hear good.
Mm. Well, Charlie, that thing you're talking about will probably work on resentments where I've done something to them. But how about those that did it to me, and I didn't have anything to do with that, and I didn't set it in motion? How about those that hurt us as kids growing up? How about the sexual abuse? The mental abuse, the physical abuse. I've heard all the time I've been in AA about the sexual abuse you ladies undergo, and certainly many of you have. But also, men undergo sexual abuse too. I've taken lots of fifth steps. Almost invariably in every one of them, there's some of that stuff that comes up in our inventories too. How about those that hurt us that way? And we didn't have anything to do with that. Aren't we justified in having that kind of resentment? I guess we are if we want to get drunk over it. But a justified resentment will get you drunk just as fast as an unjustified resentment will. A justified resentment blocks you off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And God can't direct your thinking. Because whatever you're resenting is directing your thinking, and God can't. And if we've got one of those and we don't want to get rid of it, let's put it on this sheet. Let's put down who it was. Let's put down what they did to us. Let's put down the part of self that was affected. Let's put down the part that we played, in this case, nothing. But then let's look in the fifth column. Are we using that resentment for some selfish purpose? Are we so dishonest with ourselves we refuse to see the truth behind it? If you got a resentment in your head today, and I don't care what it is, then it's not truth. Oh yeah, it started with truth. Oh yeah, it's partially truth. But if you've played it over and over and over and over and over, you've distorted it, and it's no longer the absolute truth. Only God knows the truth. We human beings know the truth as we perceive it to be. And our perception behind many of these kind of resentments is no longer true. Are we honestly looking at it and seeing the truth behind it? Are we so afraid of facing life without that resentment that we're afraid to turn it loose? You know, one of the greatest excuses in the world is, I could have done that if they hadn't have done that to me. I could be that if they hadn't done that to me. The lady in the book used this resentment against her mother to rationalize and justify her lack of education. After all, if Mama hadn't have done that to her, she could get an education. Bull. She could have gotten an education if she wanted to bad enough, regardless of what Mama did. She used that resentment against her mother to justify her marital failure. Bull. Mama didn't have anything to do with her marital failure. She used that resentment against her mother to justify her alcoholism. Bull. Mama didn't make her alcoholic. I tell you why she became alcoholic. She kept on drinking whiskey. And she became an alcoholic. Mama had nothing to do with that.
Mama didn't drink the whiskey.
You see, if we've got one of those kind of resentments, we are so used to using that resentment to justify not doing what we should do, or just as importantly, to justify doing things we shouldn't do, that sometimes we're simply afraid to face life without that thing. We better look at that closely. Are we so inconsiderate of another human being that we fail to recognize that people that do those things to us, they're not necessarily bad people, they're sick people. They did it to us out of sickness rather than badness. They didn't necessarily do it to us anyhow. They would have done it to anybody under those circumstances. If we can even begin to think about that, maybe we could start straightening out a relationship with another human being before it's too late. At the very least, what we can do with those resentments and try to forgive another human being, we can keep them from controlling our lives. It doesn't make any sense to let them hurt us 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago and let them hurt us every day for the rest of our life. As long as we're carrying the resentment, they've got us, they're controlling us, they're directing our thinking. God can't, they can, and it's just that simple. And if you honestly look at those kind of resentments, you get rid of them too. And if nothing else works, the final thing is, by God, pray for them. And oh, that's hard to do. It is hard to do to pray for somebody that's hurt you and you didn't have anything to do with it. Now, that doesn't mean if we pray for them, it doesn't mean that we're going to have to like them in the future. It doesn't mean we're going to walk hand in hand with them the rest of our life. What it does mean is we're tired of letting other people make us sick. And we can get rid of those resentments too if we pray for those people. In other words, we can become resentment free to the level that God intends for us to be. We'll never be entirely free of resentments because they do serve a useful purpose if they are used in the right way. Joe, give an example of the right use of a resentment, please.
Yeah, that's a natural ability. All this is God-given. This is why we're not going to get rid of anything. You know, in a book that talks about a scheme of rearrangements and adjustments, moving things around, putting them back where they belong, and then having a program to keep them in place. You know, we have, it's not by chance that we have, we are competitive people. When someone does something constructive, successfully, it threatens my self-esteem. After all, that guy got out there and did that. Now, if it threatens my self-esteem and in fact makes me get up and motivates me to use my intelligence to complete a task, then that means my health of resentment, I resented what he did, so I got up and did something constructive, and mankind as a whole is better off as a result of that. Because remember when the situation back in the 70s, I think it was, 60s, the Russians shot up the Sputnik. Woke up one morning, that damn thing was going round and round and round. We resented the hell out of that, them doing that.
Made us madder than hell.
Yeah. And we said, we're going to beat them. We're going to the moon. Well, we never would have attempted what we had if we not hadn't reacted to them. So, but resentments are necessary, and they're natural, and they're God-given. But it's how we use them because of self. They get out of control in our lives and destroy us. Then I use the one about the guy in the neighborhood that I live in my neighborhood, and these houses need some work on. They don't look too good. Some of the windows broke out. Some of the houses need painting. But most of us been around there. It's not all right with us. We sit around every day and rock on the front porch. And we enjoy our neighborhood. One day a new guy moves into the house across the street, and he starts painting his house and putting in window paint. Represent the hell out of that guy. Who is that? Who in the hell is he moving in here messing up his neighborhood? So we look at our houses. We never have looked at them until he moved in. And we look at our house and we said, "Believe we'll fix it." So I fix up my house a little bit. And next door neighbor sees me fixing up my house. He fixed up his house. And pretty soon God got the whole place cleaned up. So that's a healthy resentment. But the alcoholic don't operate that way. He just sits on his porch every day and rocks. Don't do nothing. And one night he'd go over and burn that guy's house down. It's the way we use it. We got to find a better way. Got to make a change. You know? So we're always going to be competitive. We are highly competitive people. And that's good. I think sometimes, you know, God gave us the ability to live highly. I think the alcoholic is going to be sometimes in recovery. He's going to be highly successful or a complete failure. And we never can find that medium. There's no medium for us. It's either one or the other.
Thank you all for being here. We hope you've enjoyed it. We certainly have.
Six and seven, four, five, six, and seven from the Big Book, Joe, and Charlie. Welcome them.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Charlie Furman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Charlie.
Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the grace of the power that I found through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Can't hear you.
We don't have the power on yet. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Lack of power is our dilemma.
Lack of power, that's my dilemma.
That's our dilemma.
Can you hear me now? All right. Okay. I was saying that because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the grace of the power that I found through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found necessary to take a drink for 11,518 days today. One day at a time. For this, I'm very grateful. We're going to try to move right on into this thing this morning. We're going to briefly review the resentment thing, and then we're going to go right on in with the rest of step four. Joe, you got anything you want to bring up here?
No, my name is Joe, and I don't look like it, but I'm an alcoholic. And it's truly by God's grace and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I found in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sober this morning, and for that I'm very, very thankful. Have anybody in here ever had any mustard greens besides Joe and I?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you won't understand this story unless you had some. But there was this traveling salesman, and he broke down, and he saw this house way over there, so he walked over and knocked on the door and said, my car's broke down out here. Could I spend the night? The farmer said, yeah, but we don't have a daughter. He said, well, it's okay. I'll spend the night anyhow. So come on in. We're about to have dinner. So they went in and sat down there about to have dinner, and there was one great big bowl of mustard greens sitting there. And God, this guy liked those mustard greens, and he'd pick them up and eating them. And the farmer said, hey, fella, if you don't be careful, we won't have anything left for breakfast. That's all we got. Poor. So they went to bed, and after a while, there was a noise down at the barn, and the farmer had to get up and go down to the barn to check out that thing. And this guy's wife, the farmer's wife, said, all right, now's your chance. He jumped up and run in and eat the rest of them mustard greens. He liked mustard greens. That's terrible.
Joe? My name is Joe, and I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
And through God's grace, because the program works one day at a time in my life, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since the 10th of March, 1962. For this, I'm extremely grateful, and a lot of other people are grateful.
Especially Lou Bell.
Yeah, especially Lou Bell.
You don't want to say nothing else?
Let me do a review.
I don't make any difference. We followed a little procedure yesterday in taking a look at our resentments. And basically, we're going to use that same procedure as we go on through the rest of our four-step inventory. And remember, we had that sheet laid out with the five columns in it. And we looked at the first three columns first. And we said it was nothing new, not bringing anything new into AA. It was simply page 65 in the blank form. We recommended that as we fill those columns out, rather than go from left to right, that we do them one column at a time. And we found in the first column, we listed who and what we are resentful at, and what we're angry with. And for most of us, as we filled out the first column, for the first time in our lives, we really realized how many resentments we really do have. We didn't think we had very many till we started putting them on paper. And as we begin to see how many resentments we really do have, we begin to see that it'd be impossible for God to direct our will, our thinking, as long as we had that many resentments. Because whoever we're resenting and everything, they control our thinking, and if they do, then God can't. We learned that simply from filling out column one. Column two, we put down the cause of the resentment, whatever it was that they did to us that causes us to resent them. We found in column two, we begin to realize it's really not them we resent, it's what they've done to us that's got us upset and got us angry and got us resentful. We said that was very important information because later on, we're going to have to start forgiving people for what they've done to us. We're going to ask them to forgive us for what we've done to them, and certainly we're going to have to forgive them also. And part of the forgiving process starts right here in column two, when we begin to concentrate more on what they've done rather than who they are. Very valuable information. We filled out the third column. We found it would be impossible for us to be upset with another human being unless they have done something to threaten one of our basic instincts of life. You threaten our social instinct, our security instinct, our sex instinct, automatically we begin to be angry and we begin to resent them for doing so. As we fill out the third column, we also begin to realize where anger really does come from. Most of us have had a lot of trouble with anger in the past, tried to control it and couldn't do it. And one of the reasons we couldn't control it is simply we didn't know where it came from. And you can't solve a problem till you understand the problem. For the first time in column three, we begin to see where our anger comes from, a threat to one of our basic instincts of life. That's how we react to that. We also found that if our basic instincts of life are under control, If our relationship with God is okay, then we don't have to react with anger. But it really doesn't make any difference who it is and what they do to us. If our instincts aren't under control, if our relationship with God is not right, we're going to react with anger almost every time. So we simply begin to see that maybe we have a choice in this anger thing. Maybe if we get our instincts under control, maybe if our relationship with God is okay, then what people do and say to us doesn't upset us, and we don't have to get mad, and we don't end up getting drunk over those situations. So we learn really three good things just by filling out the sheets. Number one, how angry we really are, how many resentments we really do have. Number two, it's not them we resent, it's what they've done to us. Number three, it's really not even what they've done to us. It's how we choose to react to it based upon our instincts and our relationship with God. Another thing I think you'll find in column three is you'll begin to see at least one part of self really stand out. Some of us, if we keep checking under social instinct, self-esteem, we begin to see where that's really a problem for us. Others maybe will be checking more under the security instinct, or maybe even under the sex instinct. It's probably going to be a combination of all three, but I think each one of us individually will begin to see at least one part of self that really stands out and gives us a real problem when it comes to our reaction to other people. Valuable information. After we filled out those three columns, we begin to realize how much time we've really wasted in resentments. The book says when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And most of us have found that we spent literally thousands of hours in the past through resentments, trying to get even with them and so on and so forth. We found it really didn't do us any good whatsoever. Absolute, complete, wasted time. We also found that when harboring these resentments, we're shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit. And shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, we don't feel good. And if we don't feel good, eventually we start thinking about taking a drink, and we end up drunk all over again. And that, the book says that's the main problem with the resentments. They will cause us to get drunk. It suggested we go back now and look at it from a different angle entirely. Always before we look to see what those suckers had done to us, today we look to see what that resentment is doing to us. And if it's going to block us off from God and get us drunk, then we're certainly looking at it from an entirely different angle. The book also talks about the fact we begin to realize that the world and the people have really dominated us through our resentments toward them. I always thought I had it. Nobody told me what to do. I didn't need anybody else's advice. And I suddenly realized that other people have told me what to do and control my thinking and my actions and my life throughout my entire lifetime, always acting and reacting based upon what other people said and what other people did. That began to look kind of stupid to do that. And about 95% of the resentments automatically began to disappear when I saw how stupid they really were. We found a way, too, for those resentments that were deeply, deeply embedded that didn't automatically begin to disappear when we saw the stupidity behind them, we saw that we could pray for those people also. And through the praying for those people, the prayer, which is an expression of love, actually overcame the anger and the resentment. And we found we could be resentment-free to the level that God intended for us to be. As the resentments disappeared, they had to be replaced with something else. And that part of our mind, which has been controlled by resentments, now is controlled by love, patience, tolerance, compassion, and goodwill toward our fellow man. That's God's thinking. Automatically, it takes the place of the resentments. We found we didn't have to go to any other fellowships, read any other books, to get love, patience, tolerance, compassion, and goodwill. If God dwells within us, that's always been a part of our makeup. Just never could use it before. But now that the resentments are gone, it automatically comes to the surface. And much less chance of getting drunk now than we were before we started the inventory process. The final thing we had to look at was, it would do no good to get rid of resentments today if I didn't know how to keep them from coming back in the future. Because the world's full of sick people. They're going to do it to me again tomorrow. So the book suggested I go back and look at that column 4 and 5 and look to see the part that I had played in those resentments in the past. In the fourth column, we listed, well, what did we do to set that thing in motion? And we begin to realize that with practically all of our resentments, that we ourselves had made a decision, taken action based on self that ended up hurting other people and institutions. They, in turn, had retaliated against us. We, in turn, had resented them for doing so. And as we played the resentments over and over and over and over in our head, we distorted the picture, finally transferred all blame to them, and made ourselves as pure as the driven snow. My God, no wonder we loved our resentments. It's a way to go ahead and excuse ourselves, never have to look and see what we're doing, and continue living life the way we wanted to live it. We didn't recognize that until we filled out the fourth column. The final thing we looked at was in the fifth column. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, resentment, self-seeking, frightened, inconsiderate, etc.? In the fifth column, we begin to see the exact nature of the wrong, the character defects within ourselves, within our personality, that caused us to do the things that hurt other people. We begin to see if we don't do something about the removal of those things, then sooner or later we're going to keep right on doing the same old things, keep right on hurting people, keep right on and resenting until we end up drunk over it. So we begin to see if we could become a little less selfish, a little less dishonest, a little less self-seeking, frightened, a little less inconsiderate, then maybe we wouldn't be hurting people and institutions. They wouldn't retaliate, we wouldn't resent, and maybe we could find a little peace of mind and serenity and happiness. As we ended up with that thing, we found that we were doing step 4, the resentment part of it. We found in the fifth column the exact nature of the wrong we're going to talk about to another human being, the resentment being the wrong, but what's the real truth of it, what's at the core of it. We found in the fifth column the character defects we're going to be willing to turn loose of in step 6. We found in the fifth column the shortcomings we're going to ask God to take away in step 7. And then also we found that the majority of the names in column 1 were people and institutions that we had harmed. Therefore, their names will come off of that sheet and be added to a sheet to be later on for steps 8 and 9. So basically, we've got all the information we need now, resentment-wise, for steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Now, we're going to follow just exactly this same procedure in order to be able to look at the second common manifestation of self, which is fears. We're going to use the same procedure to look at the harms we've done to others in the sexual area. We're going to use the same procedure to look at the harms we've done to others other than sex. When we get through with those other sheets, we will then have completed our inventory. Right now, let's look at the second common manifestation of self, which will be fears. It starts on the bottom of page 67. Joe?
Before we go to 67, let's turn to page 18 for just briefly. And we are going to talk about a lot about fears this morning, and I have to reiterate again for myself as well as anybody else who might be interested, but we're not going to psychoanalyze ourselves. Most people, when they begin to look at their fears, they psychoanalyze themselves. They say that the reason I have all these fears is because Mama set me on the potty training chair backwards or something. But we're not going to do that. We're just not going to engage in that type of activity. What we are going to do is try to do what the book says. We're going to find the facts. We're going to face the facts. And then we'll engage in a process so we can accept the facts. And remember again that it said over there on page 64, I believe, that said that spiritual malady is overcome. We straighten out mentally and physically. Spiritual not only means my relationship with God, it means my whole total being, my spiritual being. And whenever I am resentful or fearful, I don't just get resentful and fearful in one area. My whole being, my whole spiritual being is affected. I'm resentful and fearful everywhere. And of course, I didn't know that. And remember, Dr. Jung said that ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were the guiding force of lies, these people are suddenly cast to one side. My ideas, emotions, and attitudes. And on page 18, the top of the page there, in that one paragraph tells my whole story, really. And it says, an illness of this sort And we've come to believe that an illness involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents, and anyone can increase the list. In other words, alcoholism is a family illness. And if you live with one of us very long as a practicing alcoholic, you're going to be affected by it in some manner. And as I look back into my life, I can see that my dad, I know today he had an obsession to drink. My mother had an obsession to see that he didn't drink, you see. And I grew up in this. My dad was an ice man in Tulsa. We went to California from the country and came back to Tulsa, and he became an ice man, back-breaking work 6 days a week carrying ice to people's houses back in those days. And on Saturday, he'd get paid, and he'd come back by the bootleg and buy him a pint of whiskey. He needed a drink. He wanted a drink. He deserved a drink, I think, after that 6 days of work. And he'd come in with his dollar pint of whiskey, which was what it cost in those days. And my mother saw that dollar going for that pint of whiskey that could have gone to feed these five kids she had. And she began to raise hell with my dad about his drinking. And, of course, you know how that is. My dad raised hell back with her. And I grew up in this. And we know that alcoholism is a progressive illness. It gets worse as time goes by. And my dad continued to drink. My mother continued to raise hell with him, and there began to be physical fights and verbal fights in my house. And I grew up in this, and I was affected by it emotionally. From time to time, my dad would tell us kids, said, "Boys, I'm going to take your mom out and kill her this weekend." Drunk. And I'm just five, six, 7 years old, and I believe he's going to do that. And I was affected emotionally about this. And I'd be sat home all weekend wondering if he's going to do that this time. Is he really going to do that? So I was affected by it. My dad began to pull out knives and guns around the house, and he got pretty violent. And my mother had to have him arrested and committed to the Eastern State Hospital of Bonita, which is our local nut house. And he was an alcoholic, and he was to stay there till he got well. Think about that. And they didn't have alcoholic treatment in 1949, but they did have a criminally insane ward. And that's what they did with alcoholics in those days. They put them in the criminally insane ward, and they were to stay there until they got well. Now, some of the most formidable years of my life, my dad was there for 3 years and 7 months and 13 days. And he was an alcoholic. No way out for him. And I used to hitchhike up there, my brother and I, and take him a carton of cigarettes and a couple of dollars from time to time. And I was able to go into the criminally insane ward, and I saw my dad in there and with those other people. And it was quite scary. I saw things you're not supposed to see, and nobody. And I began, as I would come home from there, my brother and I hitchhiking, I got some ideas, emotions, and attitudes which would become the guiding force of my life. And one of them was this. I said, if God, you got to blame it on somebody, right? If God is going to do this to me and to us, to hell with him, I'll not be going. If I ever get big enough they can't catch me, I'm not going to church, that is. And I didn't go. To hell with God, what I said to myself. And another thought came to me along that line someplace was that if it hurts like this to love people, I'm going to quit loving people. It hurts too bad. So I began to push people out of my life. And another thought came to me was this. If anything good is going to happen in my life, it's going to happen because I alone made it that way. That just came to me. I didn't have any help with that at all. I'm good at that, you know. So I didn't need God, nothing, or nobody. And that's the way I live my life. Now, that's not very good coping skills, by the way. And when I got here, I had the spiritual knowledge of a 7-year-old boy. I had the coping skills of an 8- or 9-year-old boy. And I had the sexual knowledge of an 11- or 12-year-old boy that I learned on the streets. You think I didn't need to do some inventory? Yeah. So let's look back now See, I used to think all along that those ideas, emotions, and attitudes I had were very, very brave on my part. But come to find out, they're the most fearful thoughts that you could possibly have. Of course, I didn't know that. And if you threatened me, or I perceived a threat from you, in any manner, it was not good. Not good for you. I'd lash out at people. Over in my part of the neighborhood, in school, Charlie lived up the road about 3 miles, there's two kinds of people. There was those people that ran home from school, and then there was those people who ran people home from school. And that was me. I run people home from school. Because if they ever got you running, you couldn't quit. That's the way it was around my area. And I didn't want to be one of those. So out of fear, that's what I did, you see. Okay, page 67, bottom of the page. Notice that the word fear is bracketed along the side of the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Miss Jones, the employer, and their wife. See, this short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. I don't get just fearful in one place. It's about every aspect of my life. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think that fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. And here we go. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. And here it is for me. Wasn't it because that self-reliance failed me? I didn't need God, nothing, or nobody. Totally self-reliant, and it failed. Self-reliance was far as good as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse.
So we see basically the same set of instructions on that last paragraph that Joe just read, to review our fears as we had for resentments, except worded a little bit differently, which is Bill's usual way of doing things. So to avoid any confusion, we made up another little inventory sheet. We called it a review of fears. Looks almost exactly like the resentment sheet. Basically, it has the five columns on it. Column one, who or what do I fear? Now, many of us, especially we men, we say, well, we don't have very much fear. We're tough. We're macho. We're not talking about physical fear. We're talking about all those fears that run through our heads. And I didn't think I had very much fear until I started filling out that column one. And I began to find that I had fears connected with my marriage. I had fears connected with my job. I had fears connected with my children. I had fears connected with the police department. I had fears connected with the Internal Revenue Service. I had fears connected with. And as I began to fill out sheet after sheet after sheet, I began to realize how much fear I really do have. Just like with resentments, I didn't think I had very many until I put them all down on a sheet of paper and got to see them in their entirety. And I don't think any of us will ever realize how much fear we really do have until we put them down on a sheet of paper and see them in their entirety, and we begin to realize that we've made a decision in step three to let God direct our thinking. And if we have that many fears, then God can't direct our thinking, because the fears themselves direct our thinking, direct our actions, and direct our lives for us. I don't think any of us will realize that till we fill out column one. Column two, what's the cause of the fear? You'll notice it's headed up, what are they going to do to me? Am I perhaps going to jail? Am I going to lose something with material value? Am I going to lose face? Will it result in divorce? Will it destroy a personal relationship? Might I lose my job, etc.? We are not attempting to psychoanalyze. Like Joe says, we're not going to say we're afraid of the dark because mother set us on the potty sideways when we were kids growing up. No, we're not going to say that. We're supposed to have a little bit of fear anyhow, just like we're supposed to have some resentment. Right. Fear brings caution. Fear keeps us from getting hurt. You know, yeah, I'm a little bit afraid of the dark. Why? Well, I don't have headlights and I can't see at night, and that keeps me from getting hurt. I'm a little bit afraid of heights. Why? Well, I don't have wings and I can't fly. It keeps me from getting hurt. But if those kind of fears should keep me from going out after dark, keep me from riding in an elevator or an airplane, I better get them on this paper and look at them, because they're controlling and ruling and dominating my life for me. I find that most of my fears are usually centered around about one or two different things. Number one, I'm usually scared to death I'm going to lose something I've already got. I'm scared to death I'm not going to get something I really want, or I've done something I shouldn't have done, and I'm scared to death what they're going to do whenever they find out about it. If we have a fear, we have a cause for it. Column 2, we simply list the cause of the fear. Column 3, which part of self is affected? Just like with anger and resentment, I do not experience fear unless there's a threat to one of the basic instincts of life. If you threaten my social instinct, my personal relationships, if you threaten my security, if you threaten my sex life in any way, that's going to bring fear, an automatic reaction to those things. For the first time in my life, as I filled out the third column, just like with anger, I began to see where fear comes from. I thought fear was just one of those thoughts that flitted through your mind. You could do nothing about it, nothing to control it. Today I realize fear comes from a threat to one of the basic instincts of life. And it's how I choose to react to it as to whether I'm going to be fearful or not. If my relationship with God is right, if my instincts are under control, you can say and do about whatever you want to me, and I'm not going to experience fear. But by the same token, if my relationship with God is not right, my instincts aren't under control, then about everything you say or do to me creates fear of one form or another, just exactly like with resentments. Now that we understand where fear comes from, we can begin to see maybe we can do something about that. Also, just like with resentments in the third column, I think you'll probably see one part of self really stand out, and we'll begin to see how much that particular part of self controls us. Maybe our fears are mainly connected with what other people think of us. Another case, maybe our fears are primarily connected with our security. Another place, maybe it's primarily connected with our sex life. Probably going to be a combination of all three. But at least one part of self is really going to stand out and show us the part of self we're having difficulty with in the fears area, just like we did with the resentments area. Column 4. What did I do? It's headed up, what did I do, if anything, to set the ball rolling? Set in motion trains of circumstances which have led to my being in a position to have the fear. And just like with resentments, we're going to find that in the majority of the cases, sometime in the past, we've made a decision based on self, which later place us in a position to have to experience this fear. I don't think we'll ever really realize the part we play in these things until we fill out that fourth column and see the part that we've done or the decisions that we've made. If we didn't do anything, then we'd put down nothing, just like we did with the resentment. But in a majority of the cases, we'll find that we made decisions based on self which put us in a position. Column 5. Just like with the resentments. Is that fear I'm experiencing? Is it because I'm an excessively selfish person? Was it caused by dishonesty? You know, if I hadn't been lying and cheating and stealing, I wouldn't have to be afraid of what they're going to do whenever they catch me. Was it caused by my self-seeking, frightened nature in the first place? Is it caused by inconsideration of other people? Just exactly like with resentments. One or two of those things are going to stand out every time. One part of my personality is the root cause of that particular fear. So we treat it just like we did resentments, and it works out exactly the same way. Another thing I noticed also is I begin to notice on the fears sheet many of the same names that appeared on the resentment sheet. You know, I resented old Barbara. But by golly, I feared old Barbara, too. In fact, I'm a little bit afraid of her today. If she ever finds out everything I was doing 30-some-odd years ago, I'll be in a hell of a mess again today. I never had tied that together in my head. I don't think any of us will until we get it on this paper and we see how closely these resentments and these fears run right along with the same old names. I resented the Internal Revenue Service. I feared the Internal Revenue Service. In many cases, the same names kept appearing on both sheets. Now, we're in the process of doing step 4. This is the fears part of it. And once again, out in the fifth column, we're going to see the exact nature of the wrong we're going to talk about to another human being. You see, these fears stem from my selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate character. That's what we're going to be talking about in step 5 when we take this thing to another human being. I don't care how many fears a guy's got. What I'm really concerned with is what's within him that causes that fear. Is it caused by his selfishness? Is it caused by his dishonesty? His self-seeking, frightened, or his inconsiderate character? That's the root cause of it. Also in the fifth column, we're going to see exactly the same thing we did in resentments. We're going to see those character defects that we're going to become willing to turn loose of in step six. Because if we stay selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, we're going to keep on eating up with fear. That's going to block us off from God, and eventually we're going to get drunk of it, out over it. Also in the fifth column, we see the shortcomings we're going to ask God to take away in step seven. And if he can take them away and we can become less selfish, less dishonest, less self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, then we're not going to have to experience so much fear. And quite naturally, some of the names in column one will be people we have harmed that did not appear on the resentment sheet, and they will be taken off of this sheet, added onto the sheet to be used later on for steps 8 and 9. So we really are gathering up all the information we need for the fear section for steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. When we looked at resentments, we found a prayer there. That prayer on resentments was the first prayer on step 4 in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. We hear always about the step 3 prayers, the step 7 prayers. We never hear about the prayers in step 4. We saw a prayer for resentments, and now then we're going to see how to get rid of some of these fears. Now, if you think that resentments, when you saw the truth of them, looked stupid in your head on paper, just wait until you get a chance to really look at your fears honestly and truthfully. Your fears look awful good in your head. But when you get out on paper, they look double dumb. They look more stupid even than the resentments did when you really see the truth behind them. And once again, we alcoholics don't like to appear stupid. So about 95% of those fears are going to disappear automatically when we see the stupidity behind them. But once again, there will be 3, 4, 5, or 6 so deeply embedded, we're going to have extra help with that. We now come to the second prayer in the Big Book, on step 4, Joe.
We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality a way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is a way of strength. The verdict of ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. They never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fears and direct our attention to what He have us be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. We see our little prayer. We ask Him to remove our fears and direct our attention to what He have us be. And He says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. So if we use this inventory, analyze all of our fears, and seen how dumb they were and got rid of 95% of them, and then pray to God to get rid and continuously to begin to ask God to remove them, we could be without fear. It's not that we're going to be in a way perfect, but we can live above these fears that's been controlling and ruining our lives. Now, when we put these things on paper, I always like to mention how we're doing it and how the inventory process works. You put down the fears, you put down the resentments in the first column. You know, we're starting from the outside, and we're going to work in. And so we start from the name, and we put that on the first column. Then the cause, what they did. And then which part of self. We work a third column. We work from the outside in. The real exact nature of the origin of the whole thing is the fifth column. That's where it started. But you can't start. That's what we're hunting for. So we have to start from the outside and search and find the inside. Actually, it started, the resentment started from the fifth column out. You know what I mean? It's like, I resented my mother-in-law. I could just use that name, and that's all I could see about it. That's all I needed was the name and what she did, the first two columns. And I played that over and over and over. But the way the real thing started, I started out on my own dishonesty, my own unselfish actions. I did these things and hit her number one. And then she did number two and struck me number three. So I started the whole thing. But I couldn't see that in my head. I couldn't see that till I put it on paper.
Theory is going to be the same identical way, just exactly.
I myself set the ball rolling. All my fears start with me.
You know, prior to the Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have any God in my life. So who did I depend on? Me.
Me.
And our book says perhaps there's a better way. But we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. I've already done step three, so I'm on a different basis. I can start trusting and relying upon God. We trust our infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we think we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. And it says down there, so we ask Him to remove our prayer and direct our attention to what He would have us be, the other prayer. I'm constantly asking God to remove the fear and direct my attention to what He would have us be. And my sponsor, Franklin, told me that the most important things about prayer, one was to start and the other was to continue. And as I look back, every time I have prayed in my life, I changed just a fuzz, hardly noticeable to anybody, including me. And the next time I pray was just another little fuzz, hardly noticeable. And as time goes by, I can see a major, major change in me. I am not what I used to be, thank God. I have changed. I am becoming that which God intended for me to be, because that's my prayer. And these fears that I used to have that controlled and dominated my life are gone. I don't have those, and I have faith in God and trust in God today, which I didn't have before. And with that, I don't have to react to you fearfully and to overreact and harm you in any way. I don't want to do that. Sometimes I have done that, but I don't want to do that. And normally I don't do it because God is in my life.
We hear always about the promises on page 83 and 84. We never hear about the promises that are spread throughout the entire book. I think we just read one of the greatest promises to be found anywhere in the book. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be instead. At once, we commence to outgrow that fear. If you got a fear that's giving you a hard time, giving you a lot of trouble, if you'll do it just like we did with resentments, if you'll ask God to remove that on a daily basis, if you'll ask Him to remove it every time it comes up, if you'll ask Him to direct your attention to what He would have you be instead, at once you commence to outgrow that fear. And you wake up some morning and that fear is gone, absolutely, completely. You know, I've had two or three instances in my life. I had a lady from New York City. Told me one time, she said, "Charlie, I'm absolutely scared to death to ride on that subway system." She said, "I don't have a car. I don't like buses. I really can't get around very good." She said, "What could I do about that?" I said, "Well, you do what the big book says." I says, "You ask God to remove that fear and direct your attention to what He would have you be instead, and you'll commence to outgrow that." And I said, "Now, if that happens to you," I gave her my name and phone number. I said, "If that happens to you, please call me and let me know how this comes out." I don't know when it was, maybe 60, 80, 90 days later, she did call me from New York City. And she said, "Hey, that damn thing really does work." She said, "I've been riding that subway system all over New York City, just completely exhilarated by the fact that she could do that. And this thing really does work." I just think this file cabinet that I had in my store yesterday that had filled with fears has now been emptied out. The fears are gone. And once again, the natural law applies. Nature abhors a vacuum. God's not going to leave another hole in my head. I've got enough already. If those fears disappear, they've got to be replaced with something else. The only thing that can replace them would be the opposite of the fear. And where my mind used to be filled with fear, now it's filled with faith and courage. I find I have the ability to do many, many things that I couldn't do before. I find I have the ability to quit doing some things I thought I had to do before, too. Now, if my mind is filled in that part of my mind, if it's filled with faith and courage instead of fear, then once again I've had a very, very positive happening. See, there's nothing negative about any of these action steps. Every one of them brings about something good. If the fear has been replaced with faith and courage, I'm getting a little more peace of mind, a little more serenity, a little more happiness. I'm in much less chance of drinking now than I was before I started this process. But also, just like resentments, if you've got a fear that you don't want to get rid of it, then you better look at it very carefully. Knowing good, full well it might get you drunk, and you don't want to get rid of it, you better look at it very, very carefully. Because we can use fear to rationalize and justify not doing things we really ought to go do, or just as importantly, to rationalize and justify doing things we shouldn't do. Let me give you an example this morning. I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to please be honest with me. How many of you in this room would like to go back to school and finish your education? Could I see your hands? Man, there's a whole bunch of you that would like to do that. Now I'm going to ask you another question. Please be honest with me. How many of you really intend to do that? Could I see your hands? I'd say less than a fourth of the hands went up this time. Why? Nothing in the world but fear. Fear we can't measure up. Fear of failure. Fear of hard work keeps us from doing things we really would like to go ahead and do. So if we've got one of those and we don't want to get rid of it, let's look at it closely. We're using it to rationalize and justify just exactly like we did with resentments. We can get rid of those fears too.
I had this friend named Todd. And Todd, about 12 years ago, I was sponsoring him, and he was unemployed and unemployable. And I said, Todd, is there anything you want to do with your life? What have you always wanted to do? He said, well, I've always wanted to be an engineer. I said, well, why don't you go back to school and be an engineer? He said, I don't even have a high school education. I said, well, go back and get your GED, and go to Tulsa Junior College, and maybe you can go on to college. Well, he did those things, got on the Dean's Honor Roll in the Tulsa Junior College, got a Scholastic Scholarship at the University of Tulsa Engineering School in Tulsa, and today he's an associate engineer out in Sacramento for a company. He called me last summer and he said, you know, I've got 3 more months of going to school and I'll be a full-fledged engineer. Yeah. Way back then, he said, do you have any idea how old I'll be when this happened? I said, you have any idea how old you're going to be anyhow? Yeah. So he's got it today, thank God.
Okay, the third common manifestation of self. We talked about this storeroom that I had in the back of my head yesterday that was filled with guilt and remorse associated with the people I've hurt in the past. God can't get in that storeroom and direct my thinking till I do something about that guilt and remorse. I can't do anything about that guilt and remorse until I see the truth behind it also. Now it seems as though we human beings hurt each other easier and faster in the sexual area than we do in any other way. Now, we're a little bit different than the other animals here on Earth. The other animals on Earth, they have the same sex urge that we do, so that they can and will reproduce themselves. But the difference between the other animals and us is they don't have this thing called self-will. They can't make decisions about their sex life. Whenever it becomes time for them to reproduce themselves, God usually signifies that by some physical change in the female of the species. The male senses that change, prepares himself, the two join together, and it's kind of like bang, bang, thank you, ma'am, and when it's over with, they usually go their separate ways. You see, they didn't think about having sex before they had it. They couldn't determine when they were going to have sex. That was done on God's time. They can't determine who they're going to have sex with in the majority of the cases. They can't determine how many times they're going to have sex. They can't even determine what position they're going to have sex in. Therefore, you see very, very few sexual problems amongst the other animals here on Earth. I've never seen a cow on a psychiatrist's couch yet talking about sexual dysfunction. They just don't have those problems. We human beings are a little bit different. Not only do we have the sex urge so we can and will reproduce ourselves, but God gives us this thing called self-will, and He allows us to make decisions about our sex life. You see, we can have sex any day of the year that we wish to. We can determine who we're going to have sex with. we can determine whether we're going to have sex with one or more sexual partners. We can determine how many times we're going to do it, providing we're physically capable of doing so. We can even decide what position we're going to do it in. Now, they tell me there's something like 64 different positions a human being can have sex in. I have no idea what they are. I only found three in my lifetime. And two of them damn near killed me. I'm not sure I'm going back to that either.
Gets excited, doesn't he?
So what we're going to do here for just a few minutes this morning is we're not going to talk about how we do sex. We're going to talk about how we think about sex. Because how we think about sex determines what we're going to do with it. And that in turn determines whether it's going to hurt other people or not. And whether we're going to have to suffer the guilt and the remorse and the fear associated with those kind of things. And Bill gives us a very simple procedure to do that.
Charlie, can we turn to this before we get into that?
Oh, yeah. We don't want to interrupt sex when we once get started.
No,